Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on Anishinaabe territory in Thunder Bay, Ontario, part of the Robinson Superior Treaty, home of the Fort William First Nation. I am your host, Courtney Harrop, from the traditional territories of the Tlaaman Nation in Powell River, BC. In this episode...
Added to their weakness is the fact that the urban and the Sharifian elites of the time were subservient to British colonial powers.
Stop the practice of applying for above-guideline rent increases in Parkdale.
If we're thinking about engaging youth, which I think is really critical and important, we have to do some translation pieces. We have to make it accessible.
Radio Free Palestine, a 12-hour radio marathon to commemorate the Nakba. Updates on the Parkdale renter strike in Toronto. And highlights on the future of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis broadcasting gathering in Edmonton.
But first, here are the headlines. Gretchen King from CKUT Radio in Montreal brings us this headline on Mi'kmaq communities uniting to stop Elton gas.
Mi'kmaq communities and non-Indigenous allies are standing together to protect the Sa-Pe-Kena-Gadi River, also known as the Shubenacadie River, since 2014. Rebecca Moore from the Ecology Action Center, a grassroots organization based in Halifax, is hosting an info session at the Mi'kmaq Friendship Center about the Elton Gas Project and the movement to stop it. The Elton Gas Project proposes to drill tens of salt caverns a kilometer deep to store liquid natural gas in the Stewiacke region of Mi'kma'ki, Nova Scotia. Rebecca is mobilizing to stop Elton gas because this process will also produce salty brine waste to be dumped by the tons into the river system each day.
It's a fundraiser slash like information session because what we're trying to do is raise the money so that we have the TP to set up and block them physically from going in and starting work. And all they have to do is go in there once they, so they have to go in and clear this canal that got full of mud. And then once they go in there and clear that canal, all they have to do is flick a switch and it's turned on all their machines or whatever. And so we're going to block them so that they can't get in there, go to work and clean the canal and all that stuff. We're going to stop it. So the information session is about everything. It's about sharing, not only what we're doing in our initiative on the first, but also about how this is how they're trying to put their foot in the door for fracking in Nova Scotia and lift the moratorium for fracking in Nova Scotia. And, like, not a whole lot of people know what's going on or have even heard of this. And we've been protesting this for, like, I don't know how many years already, but we've been protesting this for a while.
Learn more about upcoming actions by frontline Mi'kmaq land and water protectors who are working to raise public awareness of the risk Elton gas poses to water, climate, energy systems, Indigenous rights, and environmental rights. Visit stopeltongas.wordpress.com.
And now we turn to the End Immigration Detention Court Challenge in Toronto.
On May 15th in Toronto, hundreds of community members, activists, and former immigration detainees and their loved ones gathered at the Federal Court of Canada to hear a historic case challenging the constitutionality of Canada's immigration law and the federal government's heavily criticized practice of indefinite detention. This is the first time that the Canadian Border Services Agency has been called on to justify its practice of long-term imprisonment. The End Immigration Detention Network, a party in the case, presented arguments that indefinite immigration detention is a violation of international law and Sections 7, 9, and 12 of the Charter and Rights of Freedoms. The End Immigration Detention Network's case is based on evidence from two of its members who have organized with hundreds of detainees, three legal experts, and five former detainees and family members. End Immigration Detention Network member Nisha Toomey was quoted in a press release by the network as stating, "It really comes down to one question for the federal government. How long can someone be held before it becomes indefinite?" People have been held for years on end. Some have died in detention. Trudeau must address the lack of policies limiting detention in Canada. We need a 90-day limit. Since 2000, at least 15 people have died in immigration custody in Canada. McDonald Scott, an immigration consultant who has provided legal support on the federal case, was quoted as saying, "Indefinite immigration detention violates international legal norms." Recently, the case of Kashif Ali, a Superior Court judge asked the government, "How long is indefinite? Give me a time when it becomes indefinite." The government could not provide a time and clearly believes they can hold people as long as they like.
That's it for the headlines. Stay tuned to Groundwire for more community news broadcasting from coast to coast to coast. We'll be right back after this.
What have you seen in your short long life? Where did your tiny feet roam? All the things you have done on top of being a wife, a mother, a daughter, a home. What have you seen in your short long life? What has your heart overcome? The traditional ways that are hidden away can be revived by the beat of a drum. What have you seen in your short long life? What did those tiny hands do? Stretching, scraping, fixing and making, mending the skins that our souls fit within, stitching, nothing can undo.
What did those tiny hands do?
What have you seen in your short long life? What has your heart overcome?
You just heard Tiny Hands by Quantum Tangled, whose album Tiny Hands recently won a Juno Award for Indigenous Music Album of the Year.
Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio station. Now it's time for our feature stories. The Parkdale renters' strike in Toronto is entering its fourth week, calling on slum landlord Metcap to address repair requests and not to increase rents above the Ontario guidelines of 1.5%. Ome Salma Rahimtula brings us an update on the strike and the recent victory in shutting down the annual general meeting of the Federation of Rental Housing Providers.
On May 1st, 150 tenants in the Parkdale community in Toronto began a coordinated rent strike to pressure their landlord Metcap Living to withdraw its above guideline rent increase application, AGI, and to complete the hundreds of outstanding repairs requested by tenants. The current rent strike is entering its fourth week and builds on the success of a lawsuit won by 35 tenants against another Parkdale slum landlord company, Achilles, in 2015, as well as a history of rent striking in Parkdale going back to the 1970s. Teresa is an organizer with Parkdale Organized and a Parkdale community member.
Our first demand is withdraw all AGI application, all pending AGI application. Our second demand, stop the practice of applying for above-guideline rent increases in Parkdale. Our third demand is address all pending repairs. For each year, the province will give a suggested amount in which landlords are able to increase their rent, and this number depends on inflation and the cost of living. This year, in 2017, that's 1.5%. So an AGI is a shorthand for above-guideline rent increase. Now, this is a loophole within the law that allows landlords to really gouge their tenants with this kind of idea that they're increasing the rent because of expenditures that they had to invest in the building. But the problem is with a lot of these Parkdale buildings, they have been, since the 80s, this kind of mass depreciation. So you have slum landlords really not investing in buildings, and this all being kind of allowed to happen via like these cultural programs of criminalizing Parkdale tenants. And so suddenly the landlords are then investing, but they should have invested. They should have done these repairs long before.
Barb is a resident in Parkdale and is participating in the rent strike.
In my unit particularly, I'm dealing with mice and cockroaches, and I've just had a new bait trap put down for mice. and I've had them come in and gel for cockroaches, but I'm coming home even yesterday, and there's cockroaches running through my cupboard, and it's just disgusting. This has been ongoing for months.
If the AGI request goes through, it will result in an increased cost for residents. For example, at the 87 Jamison building, MedCap is requesting the maximum AGI, which amounts to 15% over 3 years, or $150 per unit increase in rent cost a month.
Well, it's going to be a stretch, that's for sure, and not just for me, but for working class and immigrant families and people on fixed incomes. These increases are too high, and I think that MedCap is trying to force tenants out so that they can change the neighborhood and force people out of their homes, and they can charge higher rents for these new vacant apartment units.
The move by MedCap is part of an alarming gentrification trend in the Parkdale neighborhood of Toronto that is pushing out working class and immigrant families from affordable and centralized housing options.
And this is a part of a larger process, a larger program to displace working class and immigrant community members from Parkdale. And again, we have to remember these are members that have lived in Parkdale for decades, that called this place their home for sometimes 10, 20, 30 years. These people have lived here, some of them their whole life, and are now being pushed out. The Parkdale rent strike is really unprecedented, and the MedCap rent strike. And I believe that all working class and immigrant communities that throughout the world and in North America in particular are looking to Parkdale as a beacon, as a form of a really successful resistance, because right now the MedCap Parkdale rent strikers have only been successful. We have 200 rent strikers and our base is solidifying at the moment and we are growing our numbers.
Very soon, MedCap can file an application to the Landlord and Tenant Board to evict the striking tenants, and the board can charge each tenant with a $190 filing fee.
Because if all of our tenants continue on the rent strike and end up before the Landlord and Tenant Board, there's that $190 fee that MedCap pays that we would have to refund and pay ourselves, which would be a hardship. And if we go and protest before the Landlord and Tenant Board, we would be charged back that $190 fee.
To help cover the cost of the filing fee, visit GoFundMe.com/support-Parkdale-tenants and follow the striking tenants on the Parkdale Organized Facebook page. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Ome Salma Rahimfula on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit in Toronto.
Thank you to Ome Salma Rahimfula for that report.
May 15th, international commemorations were held of the 69th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba, or the catastrophic events that led to the creation of the apartheid state of Israel. In Canada, commemorations included a 12-hour live international marathon airing on tens of stations hosted by CKUT in Montreal. The broadcast, called Radio Free Palestine, provided historical context for the Nakba, today's resistance movements like the ongoing Dignity Strike and the international solidarity movements from Turtle Island to Palestine. Laith Marouf from CKUT provides us these highlights.
Welcome to the first hour of Radio Free Palestine International broadcast. On this hour, we will be starting with the history behind the Palestinian Nakba. What led to the Palestinian Nakba? The first guest that I interviewed was Professor Asad Abu Khalil.
The Arabs were in a state of weakness at the time, and added to their weakness is the fact that the urban and the Sharifian elites of the time were subservient to British colonial power. So you have the British not only had the loyalty of ruling families of major cities and so on, but also like even rival families were both on the payroll of the British, like the Al Saud and the Hashemites, who later were awarded Jordan and Iraq by the British. It was during those tumultuous times that the Arabs were given false promises about Arab independence.
Roland, we are here in Canada supposed to be commemorating the 150 years of the colonial state here. tell us more about the Indian Act, because this law was on the books for over a century.
Well before Canada was a country. First of all, even before Great Britain had officially left, Canada was already engaged in the process of what they wanted to call gradual civilization. And it was based on what a British missionary had done in Tasmania. And the great thing that he'd been able to do was get the Aboriginal Tasmanians walled off onto these little islands and then eventually kill them with starvation and legal requirements and so on that were admired by the settler governments in Canada. And so these notions of gradual civilization were based around the idea of isolating native peoples and then under the appearance of trying to civilize native people, kill them. I mean, this was a discussion that was going on contemporaneously in the United States. There was only two options right across North America, Turtle Island. It was either we assimilate or we exterminate.
On April 17, 2017, 1,500 Palestinian political prisoners launched an open-ended hunger strike. The prisoners represent every major political party and faction coming together under the single banner of freedom and dignity. Nearly an entire month later, the prisoners remain without food, and many are suffering severe health effects of going so long without eating. This hour, we examine the hunger strike in more depth, exploring why this hunger strike is taking place and what the situation is of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. We'll hear from the head of the Prisoner Support Committee in Nablus, Raed Amer, and Israeli activist Miko Peled. In addition, we'll draw the connections between a hunger strike in the immigration detention facility in the state of Washington in the U.S. this April and the Palestinian hunger strike that is ongoing in a number of Israeli-run prisons. First, we go to Raed Amer, who has been a major supporter of the hunger strike and is based in Nablus in the West Bank.
The hunger strike began on the 17th of April with over 1,500 participants. The goal of the strike is to achieve the prisoners' humanitarian demands. They are asking to have the same rights as any other prisoner in the world. Their demands are first to allow their families to visit them without glass barriers or locked rooms, to allow their children to kiss their imprisoned parents. Secondly, the problem of medical care in Israeli prisons. There is a huge disregard for the health and medical care of the prisoners. They don't provide medicines to the sick prisoners.
We have with us right now Manar Mhawash, who is going to join us to speak about the situation in Yemen.
Well, it's clear that Yemen has become the latest latest victim of colonialism, as you could say. Just as Palestine was a victim of Israeli colonialism and Western imperialism, Yemen is finding itself to be in the same kind of foothold. And both Saudi Arabia and Israel are recipients of massive amounts of U.S. military aid. And so, you know, they're armed to the teeth, and they are basically creating these regimes and terrorizing both Palestine and Yemen. And what's so interesting about Yemen is that, as you framed it, I mean, it is, you know, such a historic place for the Middle East. Throughout history, it has been one of the richest, nations in the Middle East, basically until Saudi Arabia colonized it. And so what we're seeing today is we're seeing one of the most dire human rights situations and crises in the world taking place in the heart of the Middle East with barely any coverage from the mainstream media. And most, even, you know, Arabs in the Middle East are unaware of what's taking place there because of because of the ownership of even Middle Eastern media by, you know, Turkish interests, by Saudi interests, by Qatari interests, by, you know, U.S. and Western interests. And so even Arabs, you're seeing that they don't even understand.
This report was filed for Groundwire by CKUT. For the complete archive of the 2017 edition of Radio Free Palestine, visit archive.org/details/RFP2017. You are still listening to Groundwire, a collaborative news program produced by and for community radio stations. Find out more online at www.groundwirenews.ca.
How to Steal a Canoe, from Leanne Simpson's new album, Flight.
Now it's time for our community radio report, brought to us by Gretchen King and Carly Forbes from the Future of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis Broadcasting Gathering held last month in Edmonton, Alberta. To listen to the complete conversation, visit www.indigenousradio.ca.
The gathering began with an opening ceremony led by Ruben Quinn.
Aha, neoto temetik, kiatamiskatina o gahkio. Otaho maya. Niku toasika agi tega ya asutsigeon. Nitanisko tapana musum papa steo ikisi ka satuma utaski ko muta ka ni pauyek ka apiek. Matsigaya tata wao. Egoha ya Ukuta kawe atsimutsik utehnia koska isino kawe atsimuja kio ahka miimuk tapu on kapatsihtaek miutehe on kapatsihtaek. Welcome everyone to Treaty 6 territory. This is the land of my ancestor Papa still, who signed the adhesion to Treaty 6 here. And 140 years ago, or 150, my math is wrong, he signed the adhesion to Treaty 6, and this land was reserved for his people. The land we're on right now is actually Papastel's reserve land. And through circumstances, they were forced to leave. And so what we all still consider this Treaty 6 territory, we're all treaty people, all Canadians are treaty people. And so when I think about people that are broadcasting news, I always think about the mainstream media, how it has been not always the most compassionate or kind outlet for news for my people.
Following the opening ceremony, there was a panel discussion between Lauren Crazybull, Molly Swain, and Chelsea Vowell, titled World Building in the Dystopian Future Now, Imagining and Podcasting Indigenous Futures.
Yeah, what CJSR does and campus radio generally, like from what I've seen, is really incredible with that, like the really community based stuff. But one of the things I think that's really simple and easy to do is to go to where the folks are, right? Take things out of the studio. Because I think one of the things that can be really off-putting for people in the beginning, and obviously there are people who are like super technically minded who are like all about the soundboards and all that, but you know, walking, like if you don't know anything about how radio gets made and you walk into one of those rooms and you just see, you know, thousands of dollars of equipment, and you know, it's like this really specific sort of like campus radio aesthetic, and like, you know, that whole sort of like community and that culture, that can be really intimidating for folks, I think, or at least, you know, off-putting or uncomfortable. And it, and at least in my mind, like, until you get to know sort of, you know, the fact that a soundboard, you know, you really only need to use like two or three of the sliders on it and stuff, you know, it kind of makes it seem like doing, you know, podcasting or radio or whatever is more complex than it needs to be. One of the things that we really try to, I guess, like, underscore, like, every time we talk about podcasting is that it's criminally easy. It's outrageously easy. Anybody, you know, anybody could go in and have something ready to go in 2 hours if they wanted to, right? And I think that is kind of a really good starting point, is, like, how do you introduce people to the very, very basic, and then folks who are interested in, you know, gaining those additional skills. Almost everything that you need, you can get for free. If you have access to a computer or a laptop, then you have access to free software that will let you do the thing. We shelled out a bit of money for a microphone in advance. You don't even really have to do that. Your smartphone, you know, like a little recorder like that is just fine, right? And that's, I think, one of the most incredible things about this type of media. And why I think, you know, for Indigenous people, it's even more important and even better, right? Like, I think what Lauren's doing at iHuman is going to be so incredible, because we're going to be able to spread those skills, you know, everywhere. Like, people, you know, in far-flung communities can use it, Indigenous people in urban centers. Mm-hmm. All you need is access to a computer, essentially. And, you know, whether it's archive materials from, you know, actual, like, radio stations, or, you know, like our website, for example, having the capacity to both stream and download is also really, really important and really great, because internet access is so variable. And so you can do that, right? And people can, you know, take the time, however long it takes, to download an episode and then listen to it whenever they want.
In a later presentation, Jody Stonehouse spoke to the importance of accessibility and youth engagement in CRTC processes.
Because it's a lot of language, a lot of content, and I need to thank the people who helped read some of the stuff, Brad and Christopher, because I wasn't able to process, so they supported in that. Okay, they read it, and then we talked about it, because it just isn't as easy as reading something and making sense of it, because the application process in itself felt like a whole nother language to me, and translating what is meant and what is actually being asked took some talking, and we had to get a lawyer to help, as well as Tanya as a lawyer herself, to make sense of this for me, because it's not clear to me. And so if we're thinking about engaging youth, which I think is really critical and important, we have to do some translation pieces. We have to make it accessible, and we have to make it legitimate in their own realities. Why does this matter, right? Why does this matter to you as young Indigenous people? Well, it can do this, this, and this for you. And so that's going to take a lot of work on us, and some strategizing around making it. I think the most important thing is accessible and relevant. And it is really important and relevant to their lives, because they love the radio. They create beautiful programming when given the microphone. Many of them are interested in recording, whether it be hand drum songs or hip hop songs, or they're on. If we look at YouTube and look up Indigenous youth, they are creating homemade videos for 100 years. You know, they are doing it already. So how do we take what they're doing and make it seem relational to the CRTC application is going to be a bit of work, but it's important work.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by Carly Forbes from the Groundwire National Coordination Team. Headlines this week were written by Gretchen King. We thank all of our contributors this week.
Music this week was by Quantum Tangled and Leanne Simpson.
I have been your host, Courtney Harrop. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwirenews.ca.